Radio. Stay tuned, stay locked. The street from the big chair. I want to first begin by thanking the creator for this day and the opportunity to present to you the latest installment of the Education Town Hall. And folks, it's been a difficult morning. As you know, we normally kick off at 11 a.m. Eastern time, but because of the weather conditions here recently and the aftermath and the traffic and the snow and the ice and all those things, we had some difficulty getting our team in here, but we're all assembled now, and we're ready to get started for this show. This is your humble servant, Thomas Byrd. But before we get started, I want to first thank those who have supported this show financially. I want to thank DC Voice, the 21st Century School Fund, the Senior High Alliance of Parents, Principals, and Educators, also known as SHAPE. I want to thank the Washington section of the National Council of Negro Women. I want to thank the Ward 5 Council on Education. I want to thank our dear friend Deborah Robinson. And I want to thank all the anonymous donors and sponsors who have contributed to the show. And I want to thank our major sponsor, the Washington Teachers Union, under the leadership of Elizabeth Liz Davis. And folks, if you or your organization believes that this is an important platform to give everyone access to the public square, then help us ensure that it remains available by offering your financial support. Because folks, we do have costs and bills to pay. So please contact me at thomas.byrd@yahoo.com. That's thomas.byrd@yahoo.com. We would definitely appreciate your support. I think we're going to have a great show today. And like I said, we're back in the saddle for the new year. We're going to be joined by Marla Kilfoyle of BATS, the Badass Teachers Association, and she's the general manager. As you know, the fourth Thursday is the bus show, so this is the fourth Thursday, so this is the bus show. Badass Teachers United, opt out, and save our schools, BUS, and folks, so we invite you to join us every Thursday, but particularly on the fourth Thursday for the bus show. And so we're Before we bring Marla in, I'm going to swing over to my partner, Virginia Spatz, for her feature report. Good morning, Virginia, and take it away.
About Scholastic's book's effort to sell a birthday cake for George Washington and their eventual decision to eat it instead. But many news outlets reported the situation from the publisher's press release, ignoring points of major importance for all concerned about education and literature directed at children. The book in question, meant for grades 1 through 3, depicts slaves making a birthday cake for President Washington. As School Library Journal describes it, the slaves are smiling with glee as they work on the cake, evoking a strangely cheerful and exuberant scene reminiscent of a Disney film. The journal's December review concluded, "A highly problematic work not recommended." Kirkus Reviews called it an incomplete, even dishonest treatment of slavery. In response, the book's editors, author, and publisher all offered defenses of the birthday cake story. When Scholastic changed its tune later in the month, many news outlets reported on the publisher's decision to withdraw the book. NPR and the Huffington Post focused on Scholastic's own statements, also mentioning academic criticism of the historical views in the book. The New York Times ended with a note on what it called backlash, including one-star reviews on Amazon and a Change.org petition. Missing from most reports was the grassroots outreach, which had created awareness of the book and issues surrounding it. And it was grassroots work that led to Scholastic's about-face. Scholastic was still staunchly defending a birthday cake for George Washington when Teaching for Change, the national organization dedicated to diversity in children's literature, shared a librarian's review of the book. That post went viral with the help of Badass Teachers, the New York Collective of Radical Educators, and many others. A protest petition received thousands of signatures. Within 4 days of the Teaching for Change post, Scholastic announced it was stopping distribution and accepting returns of this title. The partial reporting on this story is not only an issue of credit, of understanding how grassroots work relies on longstanding relationships and the reputation of those speaking out and of acknowledging its successes. It's also about the larger issues behind the cake story and children's publishing. As Teaching for Change explains, their response to this book is part of long-term work to address diversity in children's literature. Of the 30,000 books published in 2015 for children 8 and older, for example, only 32 were from African American authors. That's 32 books out of 30,000 published. In addition, the battle over George Washington and his happy slaves is also part of what Teaching for Change calls a longer and larger campaign for children to learn the truth about history and the world today. There is much more to this story, including issues around censorship and pulling titles due to public outcry, how much nuance readers under the age of 9 can be expected to catch, and overall decision-making behind children's publishing. Visit educationtownhall.org later today for additional discussion and links to recommended juvenile literature on slavery in the U.S. This is Virginia Spatz reporting for the Education Town Hall on WEACT Radio, powered by Ethical Electric.
Thank you so much, Virginia, for that feature report. That's something that we will continue to talk about maybe next month for Black History Month. Fantastic. All right, folks, as I said, we're going to have a great show. Marla Kilfoyle is on the line with us. And I don't know if you folks, if you've been following the Fredericks versus California Teachers Union, the case that's in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, also known as SCOTUS, which some think could mean the end of unions. It's essential that all who are interested in education and labor or the future direction of our country stay on top of this. And so Marla is joining us to talk about how this case came about and to give us updates on what's going on and what she thinks will happen going forward. So Marla, welcome back to the Education Town Hall on Bus Thursday.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Thomas. Thanks for having us.
And we apologize for the delay. I'm glad you could stick around and be with us.
My pleasure.
All right. So explain to folks who may not be familiar with Fredericks versus California Teachers Union. Give us some background on that.
Well, Fredericks is a group of nine teachers. They're California teachers. None of them have chosen to opt into paying union dues. The 10th plaintiff is the Christian Educators International Association, which is sort of trying to act like a union. And what they've decided to do was sue because they feel that the California Teachers Association is using union dues for political speech. And there are some things that these 10 plaintiffs, nine of them who are teachers, who have chosen not to pay dues. They've chosen to opt out. They feel that CTA is using dues to forward political speech that they do not agree with. For example, the nine teachers on the Fredericks side do not agree that teachers should have tenure, believe it or not.
Whoa.
Yeah. They do not believe that the union should be fighting against merit pay, which most teachers in this country do not agree with merit pay. Merit pay actually causes teachers to compete with each other when they shouldn't be. They should be collaborating. So a lot of teachers don't agree with merit pay. They also don't agree that when layoffs occur, that should be done according to seniority. And we know from a lot of the research that is out there that if you look at the idea of seniority, most senior teachers make the most money. And so unfortunately, when budget time comes down, what do you want to do? It's not about laying off people that you feel are better than others, I guess. It always is a money factor. So, you know, the most egregious part of this is that the side of Fredericks is funded by some very, very powerful right wing. I know you're shocked by that.
Yeah, I'm shocked. I'm truly shocked.
I know. Right-wing groups that are in essence looking to destroy, you know, unionism and the middle class in this country. So that's kind of a little bit of a summary of it.
Okay, so let me go back because you shared a lot there. I mean, I'm sitting here like,
sorry.
Okay, I'm just saying where do I begin? I want to start with these teachers. Are these folks really teachers? To me, they would. I don't understand. Did the right wing folks come out and find these folks to initiate this, or was it vice versa? How did they come? I don't understand this. Do you have any idea how they all came together?
Well, we don't really understand it either. You know, certainly we can't do any kind of investigation, I think, unless we probably foil tax returns or whatever. You know, but they find these people. I don't want to say that they pay them off because I can't say that. But I will tell you that, you know, these nine plaintiffs who've chosen not to fund the union, all benefit and get the services of the union. For example, one of the plaintiffs who has since retired, her name is Peggy Searcy. She has since retired. She has a pension that was bargained by the California Teachers Association. There were also some furlough issues in which, you know, she was protected and not being laid off. That was all bargained for by the California Teachers Association. So she enjoyed a lot of the benefits of unionism, but yet she doesn't want to pay for those benefits.
And, you know, to me, with regard to fundamental fairness, anybody that's not paying union dues or not part of the union should not benefit from whatever gains or benefits that the union negotiates. It's just that simple. I don't know, you know, to me, she's a hypocrite, you know, or at best, and some other things I can say at worst, but, you know, I'll just leave it there. But, you know, to utilize the gains that the union has made and then come out and then try to fight the union and destroy the union, I don't understand that. It makes no sense to me, but we're not going to worry about me. I'm probably the slowest person here on the uptake. But I know Virginia wants to jump in this conversation. So Virginia?
Yeah, I have actually two questions. I mean, one is that the teachers who are in this case and others who don't believe in a closed shop where you have to pay union dues or you have to pay some kind of fee if you don't join the union would say is that they strongly believe that the union is taking the wrong direction and that they're being forced somehow into a situation where the union speaks for them and doesn't actually support their views. So, I wanted to get a little comment on that, but also it does make me curious. Are these nine people who were really vociferous participants in the union trying to get it to take a different direction, or did they just pop up with like, okay, we're not paying money?
Those are really, really great questions. And, you know, all questions, actually myself and Melissa Tomlinson got in to the Supreme Court to hear these oral arguments. And I'll tweet out sort of our summary of it. But those are really great questions, Virginia. I want to take that first question. You know, union members elect their representatives. And the one thing that the state brought out is that the state, who is acting as the employer in this instance, needs to be able to bargain with one entity in order to, you know, manage their workplace. They can't be bargaining with 45 or 50 different groups. So what California brought out, the state of California brought out, is the fact that the union, which is elected by a majority of its members, that's democracy, right? I mean, we live in a democracy. Are we all happy with how our tax dollars are being used?
No.
So obviously you're going to have people that are not happy, but when the majority makes that decision and elects these people to be the representative of them, California is saying it's easy to manage the workplace because California is the employer here. So, you know, democracy is not clean and not everybody's going to be happy, you know. So, but at the end of the day, like Justice Sotomayor said, why wouldn't you want to subsidize something that was actually good for you? All of those nine teachers are having the union bargain things that are good for them. And not only that, Virginia, good for kids. Unions bargain things like small class size. They bargain things like extra help for children after school. They bargain all kinds of things that are great for teachers and kids. So why wouldn't you want to subsidize the things that are good for you? And the other part of that is that, look, I don't agree with a lot of the things that my state union talks about, but they do not tell me that I can't speak up. And I do speak up. I go to Albany and I speak out sometimes very opposite of what my state union speaks out. They've never told me to be quiet. So it's not telling you can't speak out against them. But, you know, these are some of the things that, you know, we have to understand in terms of democratically elected unions that work for not just in our case, work for all workers, the majority of workers who elect them, but also are working to put in place policies that are great for kids. I hope I answered your question.
You did. That was really very clear. And I hope that explanation it gets out there more because I did look at some of the press and, you know, the press kind of repeats what the plaintiffs say and it doesn't really, you know, give a very nuanced background.
So, Marla.
And I'm going to tell you, if I can just jump in, Rebecca Friedrichs, who's the lead plaintiff in this case, actually said publicly that she's got no problems with the union in terms of bargaining her pay, right?
Huh.
So you can't have a problem with the union on one end, a democratically elected union, right?
Right.
On one end, if they're bargaining your pay and your pension, but then also have a problem with them on other things like tenure. Right?
The
teachers like to do process. So just wanted to throw that in there.
Yeah. that's contradictory. I don't understand some people. But anyway, I want to now get into a little bit with the remaining time we have. I want to get into talking about now that this is before the Supreme Court. You mentioned that oral arguments have already occurred. So where are we now in the process? And give us a sense of how the Supreme Court is reacting to those oral arguments and what direction you think they may be leaning in?
Well, we know that they're due to come down with a decision in June. you know, Melissa Tomlinson and I went and looked at it. And listen, I'm a bit of a Pollyanna. You know, we needed to sway Scalia here. Scalia was pretty combative. I don't feel real strongly that we got him. However, I'm going to tell you, Chief Justice Roberts, a lot of his facial expressions and his questions led me to believe that I think he could be swayed. Hmm. And I don't think that he wants the legacy of his court to be one that is going to lead to the destruction of unionism in this country eventually, and will also lead to pushing the middle class down. So, you know, that was my view.
Hey, Marla, let me, I kind of got a little ahead of myself. I wanted to kind of ask you and find out specifically, what is Frederick's in at all trying? What remedy are they seeking?
The remedy that they are seeking is what is called mandatory agency shop fees for those states that are not right-to-work states. So we have 20 states that are not right-to-work states, where agency shop fees, according to Abood, which is another court case, Supreme Court case, been held up for 40 years by the court, that requires agency shop fees to be paid in those states that are unionized states. So these agency shop fees are mandatory, right, in these 20 states. So I live in New York. Everybody in New York has to pay agency shop fees. Now, you can choose to opt out of those fees, which means that you will pay a reduced amount, but you still have to pay. You're getting a service. So all nine of these teachers are paying a reduced amount, but still getting the same benefits that everybody else who pays the most. I hope that answered the question.
It may for some of us, but maybe not completely for me, but that's all right. I won't belabor that because we don't have a lot of time. Like, this is amazing. So you were starting to share with us, some of the reactions of some of the justices. And so, you said you're a bit of a Pollyanna. So I assume that you have, an outcome that you are hopeful for. So why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, everybody's like, oh, they're definitely going to rule on the side of Friedrichs. I don't think that. I think our liberal justices, Breyer, Kagan, Sotomayor, and Ginsburg, made great arguments. You know, the more conservative justices, you know, don't really get what happens in a school workplace. I think that Roberts, just by his facial expressions and some of his questions, could be swayed. And I think, again, I don't think he wants the legacy of his court to be the destruction of unionism in this country. So I think they're going to rule on the side of CTA and maybe change Abood a little bit, where I could see them changing the opt-in, opt-out part and maybe going back to another Supreme Court case, which was Hudson, which required people to fill out a form every year to opt into the union or opt out. I could see them maybe changing that a bit, but I don't think they're going to strike down entirely mandatory agency fees. I don't.
And so if the plaintiffs are successful in their bid to for their remedy, so kind of connect the dots. How is that really on that day? Is that the end of unions, or is that the beginning of the end? Share with us how that would unfold.
I think that's a great question. I think it's going to be the beginning of the end, and we're not going to see the destruction probably for a couple of years. Our hope is that people get so angry that this case even made it to the Supreme Court. If they rule for Friedrichs, we could see an uptick in unionism, you know, people paying into the union. However, I think that we're not going to see the destruction of it for a couple of years. Hopefully not. I mean, the hope is that it just angers enough people that they're like, you know what? I'm not leaving my union. I love my union. I agree with it. But at the end of the day, it has the propensity to make this country a right to work country. Mm-hmm. And that's scary.
And so, now let's talk about the reverse. So if they aren't successful in getting the remedies that they seek, so do you get a sense that, okay, these folks, these right-wing folks, they don't give up easy. You know, they're going to, you know, so you get a sense of they're going to be looking for another way, a backdoor into trying to continue to try to defeat the unions?
Oh, you are so good, Thomas. You are so much. Yes. they will, because Elite will fast track this through the court. And what they will do is they will find another group of people and they will bring another case forward, and they're just going to keep doing it and doing it. They're very, very well funded by, you know, the Koch brothers and lots of billionaires. So they'll just find another 9 people to do it, and they'll put it back into the court. And maybe it'll be California, maybe it'll be New York, who knows. But there really is a very strong concerted effort and well-financed effort to destroy unionism in this country, and hence the middle class.
And I'm no legal eagle or attorney by no stretch, but to me, from my knowledge of the law, they can't actually bring the same case once it's decided by the Supreme Court. So it would have to be a little different. So there will have some nuance in it. I mean, it could on surface look similar, but it can't be exactly the same case, because once the Supreme Court decides, that particular case is ended. So they would have to find another way to kind of get this into the legal system.
And bet you they will. And bet you they will. They will. And they'll find 9 more people to champion their cause, which is the saddest part about it. You know, we wrote an amicus brief. Bats wrote an amicus brief to the court for this case. And one of the things that we highlighted in that amici was that unionism in this country has uplifted women. It's getting us to a point where we're making, you know, equal money for equal pay. It's also done an immense amount for minorities. And I think that we all need to be very, very mindful about this attack on the middle class, on women, and on minorities in this country. And they will find another way. Trust me, they will.
So let me ask you, and I hope you can answer, give me a sense of this. I know you're in New York, but do you get a sense that the community, parents, and the community out in California, what side they're supporting? Are they for unions, or are they for the plaintiffs? Do y'all have a sense of where the community stands and parents stand on this?
Well, I don't in California. I mean, I can only go by what I sort of see on, you know, in our network. And obviously we're a network of teachers. We're disgusted by that. We have to also remember that teachers are parents. You know, many of us are parents. And we understand that states that are unionized have better school systems. They do. That's research proven.
Okay.
States that are unionized have better school systems. They have better education systems. Because unions bargain things that are good for kids.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I hope the justices really understand. In New York, I think I could probably very securely say that the parents, obviously, that I work with in activism understand this, and they get it, and they support teachers. They want their teachers to be able to go to school and have good workplace conditions. How do you get those? You get those by collective bargaining. And they understand that teachers collectively bargain, again, things that are good for kids.
Okay.
We bargain, you know, curriculum, class size. We bargain materials. We bargain all kinds of things that make schools great places for kids. And I hope the justices heard that.
That's going to have to be the last word, Marla.
Yay.
We've reached the top of the hour. Normally I'm saying we reached the bottom of the hour, but we're a half hour behind. So we really appreciate you joining us today to give us insight on the case and an update on the case. So they're going to be making a decision in June. So obviously there's more to come on this, and we'll have to circle back to this situation at that time.
Thanks for letting me come on and explain it.
So, folks, this has been Marla Kilfoyle, who's the Badass Teachers Association General Manager, and she's no stranger to the show. We look forward to having you back. So, as I said, we've reached the top of the hour. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and be joined by Dr. Yahuru Williams and one of our favorite folks, Denisha Jones. And we're going to talk about the United Opt-Out Conference in Philly that's upcoming. So, folks, we're glad you're along with us today, and I hope you stay with us. We will be right back. We'll be right back.
Virginia Spatz, feature reporter on WEACT Radio's Education Town Hall. Add your voice to local and national education issues by listening Thursdays at 11 Eastern Time and by contributing your thoughts on our blog, WEACT Ed, that's WEACTED.wordpress.com. WEACT Radio, powered by Ethical Energy.
I'm Tom Matzey, founder and CEO of Ethical Electric. We're America's only progressive clean energy company. We support the causes you care about every day when you pay your power bill. And so we think people, when they want to support something good like clean energy, they also don't want to support dirty energy politics. And so we offer a way to get off both dirty energy and get off of dirty energy politics. We're talking about companies that gave money, you know, to Rick Perry, the infamous Texas climate denier. That's the company that owns the largest kind of quote-unquote green energy company in New York right now, Green Mountain Energy. Ethical Electric gives you clean energy for your home. You can support progressive causes when you pay your power bill. You don't have to give all of your money to dirty energy anymore. You can get off both dirty energy and get off dirty energy companies. WEACT Radio, powered by Ethical Electric. Do something.
Hi, I'm Denise Rollard Barnes, publisher of the Washington Informer newspaper, and you've asked whether I think a show on education is a good idea for the District of Columbia, and I would give an unequivocal yes, it is. Information is power, we always know that, but information about education, resources, the politics, the finances, the what our young people could and should be achieving and what should be taught in the classroom is an exceptional. You can't talk enough about it. Let me just say that. And I'm so glad that you are having the show. Continue to do the good work that you're doing. And folks out there, you just keep listening. If there's something you don't hear on the show, I'm sure that the folks here would love to hear from you and make sure it's a topic for an upcoming show. So keep on listening.
All right, we're now back live. Thank you so much for being here with us today on the Education Town Hall. This is your humble servant and host, Thomas Byrd. And it is indeed now an honor and a pleasure to welcome to the show a new voice, Dr. Yahiru Williams, who's the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Fairfield University. And we're also joined by one of our favorite folks, Denisha Jones, who's a professor at Howard University. And they're joining us to talk about the February 26th through 28th United Opt-Out Conference. And so, Dr. Williams, welcome to the Education Town Hall. I'm sorry? I can't hear you, Virginia. And Denisha, are you there?
I'm here, Thomas.
Okay, Denisha, we're trying to link up with Dr. Williams right now. So, as I mentioned, you all are going to talk about the National United Opt-Out Conference scheduled for February 26th through 28th in Philadelphia.
Yes, so thank you again for having us on for Bus Thursday. Since United Opt-Out has formed, they have held a series of events to kind of push the opt-out movement. So we started with an Occupy, the Department of Education, 1 year, and then we did a second one of those. After that, we decided to move to different areas that were having a lot of folks, a lot of parents and students and teachers interested in opting out so that we can offer our support. So we did Denver. And then we also did Fort Lauderdale, and now we are headed to Philadelphia because Philadelphia is going through a lot of issues. They're building their opt-out movement with parents, students, and teachers, and, they're facing a lot of same issues in other urban school districts that can lead to charterization and school closure. So we wanted to be there to kind of support them. We'll be in Philly February 26th to the 28th. We have a lot of speakers coming, but this is, again, we're United Opt-Out, but we're going more than just opt-out. Our theme for this one is transcending resistance and igniting a revolution, because opt-out has always just been the beginning of reclaiming public education And so we want people to understand that the work doesn't end at opt-out. We still have to fight for strengthening our unions, racial justice, quality schools for English language learners. And so there's a lot more, but opt-out is definitely a means to kind of engage parents, students, and teachers in this fight.
So transcending resistance and igniting revolution. How did you all come up with that theme? It sounds interesting.
And yeah, all the admins meet, and we were going back and forth trying to think of something, because I think a lot of people think that it just opt-out is a form of resistance, but we have to do more than just resist. We have to be in a position to kind of spark this revolution in public education. And we all keep saying that, you know, things are getting out of control. As you heard with the Friedrichs case, you have teachers fighting to take away unions. You know, this is a big issue. It'll deal a blow to public sector unions. Charters are still being pushed. Testing is still being pushed. So resistance is not enough. You have to kind of move beyond that. And so United Opt Out has always been kind of pushing the idea of an education revolution. And so we thought that that was a good idea to show that we want to move. Resistance is a good place to start, but yeah, it can't be the only place we end.
So,
and so once we start resisting, how do we move to that revolution?
So in other words, you don't want to copy the Republican Party and be the party of no. You want to have, I assume, come up with solutions, not just say, no, we can't go in this direction, but you want to offer a better path going forward. Is that what I'm hearing?
Absolutely. I mean, the movement has always been attacked for only being, no, we don't want this. And for a long time, we were admitting that we had to first acknowledge all of the things that were not good. And we've done that. You know, United Opt Out has been doing that for years, other organizations as well. So now, yes, we have to be about what do we do want? What kind of things do we do want to see? And that's where the revolution part comes. So we can resist the harmful things that make learning and teaching difficult, and then also push for the things that we know, whether it's through research or experience, that is really what our children deserve in their public schools.
All righty. I believe we now are joined by Dr. We're not joined by him. Okay. I don't know what's going on. I know he's supposed to be on with us.
Yeah, I'm sorry about, we lost Dr. Williams. He's the one, we've asked him to come on and be on a panel. We're putting together a panel of activists and scholars to kind of address how do we push the civil rights groups onto, away from this mantra of more and more testing, and to this understanding that high stakes testing is dangerous for students, especially black and brown students. As you remember, we had the Education Justice Conference in October in New York, last year. And Dr. Williams was one of the guest speakers, and so we've asked him to come and be on this panel where we're going to be kind of changing the narrative of civil rights groups and how do we engage these groups, because it's very difficult when 12 or 19 civil rights groups say we want more testing. If you are a presidential candidate or anybody coming out against testing, then you're kind of coming up against civil rights groups, and that's very dangerous. And how do civil rights organizations who begun fighting all sorts of testing, literacy poll testing, voting testing, those sort of things, to now that they're supporting testing, when we know that standardized testing has a history built in through the eugenics movement. We know that it's always been problematic in the achievement gap. And so we're really going to kind of wrap up our efforts to get civil rights groups to understand that this push for more testing is actually hurting students, not helping them.
Okay. So Dr. Williams, I'm not familiar with him. Could you give us a little bit on his background and how he came to have a voice in this conversation?
Yeah, I only know from his involvement with the Badass Teachers. Dr. Williams has been with us for a long time. He was actually a speaker, I think, at both of our events. I know he was definitely at the Congress, and yes, he did speak at the rally before, the summer before. He's an emphatic speaker. He's great. He's very charismatic. He understands. He's a historian, so he really takes the perspective of looking at, historically what is being done to public education and kind of linking that. And so you can make those connections, which is really important. As I said, he gave one of the keynote speaks at the Educational Justice Conference. And he's just a really good person to understand what's really happening, a really good ally for this fight. And we are proud that he's a badass teacher and that he's been coming to United Opt Out as well.
Okay, so describe for us the actual logistics of the day with regard to, the days regarding the conference. So walk us through how that is going to unfold and what that's going to look like.
Yeah, so on our website right now, we're just promoting the three-day event, and I'm sorry to say, I think we're pretty close to selling out, but we have added a Thursday night event that's free and open to the public at the town hall, again, with the theme of engaging parents about the civil rights issue with testing and opting out. And so I'm waiting to get the name of the church where we're going to be in Philadelphia, but I will post that to your site so your listeners can kind of see. But that's going to be open to the public Thursday night, and so we've just added that because we wanted to make sure that we can incorporate people who can't attend the three-day event. And so then Friday evening is the kickoff to our event. We have our keynote by Stephen Krashen, who has been a United Opt-Out supporter for a very long time. And so he'll kick us off. He does a talk, and it's kind of a light evening, just him and the speaker, I mean, the listeners, the guests that night. Then we begin our event on Saturday. We have some great keynotes lined up. I'm going to pull up my copy of the schedule to share with you, but I don't know if we put this information out, but I think it's okay. We were just able to secure Jill Stein to be a guest speaker. We had someone drop out, and so as we know, I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she runs for the Green Party candidate for president. And so we're really interested to hear her thoughts on education as well. We have Chris Hedges, who's doing our Saturday morning keynote. And so he's a really interesting writer who's looked at revolution and rebellion and kind of going to help us move forward on that area. We also have Saturday afternoon Antonio Darda, who is also a professor and an organizer of educational policy. We did add it to our website. Sunday morning keynote is Jill Stein, Green Party 2016 candidate for president of the United States. And then lastly on Sunday, we also have Bill Ayers, who is a distinguished professor of education at the University of Illinois Chicago, to do our kind of closing event. And then throughout the days on Saturday and Sunday, we have panels and we also have breakout sessions, because a lot of these, we schedule this event so that people can work and come up with action plans. So we'll have a speaker and then you'll get into breakout groups. So we have a group on media and messaging for our bloggers and our radio people, so we can come up with a way to kind of cement the message and get it out to folks. We also have a group on Opt-Out 101, so we have folks in Philly who are leading the opt-out movement, so we'll organize around that for parents and teachers who are interested. We have a discussion on charter schools. We know that there are certain schools in Philadelphia who have been identified to be taken over as charters, so we want to work with people in the community who are interested in kind of fighting against that, and we have folks who are doing that in Massachusetts, so they'll come and lend their expertise. As I mentioned, Yeruhu and myself and some others will be on a civil rights panel. So throughout the day, there'll be these breakout groups and panels, and then along with the speakers, so that people can listen but also engage with each other on action steps.
And if people can't attend the conference, I'm assuming that after the conference you will share these action plans so people can get on board. But in the meantime, I wonder if you could just speak a little bit to the connection between over testing or testing in general and corporate reform of education, because you know you were talking about resisting the test, but a lot of it is really trying to organize resistance to education reform that is really being driven by profits. So is that something that this conference is going to focus on or not?
Yes, no, we definitely do a part. Our United Opt-Out has always been about fighting corporate ed reform. So a part of that is charterization, turning public schools into charter schools that are, you know, for profit. And a part of that is testing, because testing is a big business industry where it's suggested that we spend about $4 billion annually on testing. So this is very, very much corporate driven to have all of these tests that cost school districts so much money to administer, to grade, and so that's a big push for this. And corporations see the opportunity to get more and more tests out of children and more money. And you have schools spending millions on testing, but they don't have a librarian or a nurse. And so we have to understand, what are we willing to spend our money on? You know, if we want to spend it on tests, then we can't have these other things that our school needs. So there is testing very much connected to that push. We know that you guys have talked about Pearson, so you're familiar as one of the biggest company that's producers of tests and test prep materials. And that's the other part. It's not just the test, but the test prep and the consultants to come down and teach teachers how to break down a standard into testing points. It's kind of taken over for school districts, especially schools that have been forced into turnaround situations. One of our United Opt-Out members is at a school in Colorado who has been, it's been identified as a turnaround, and the whole thing that they're going through now is all about testing. They don't focus on anything else about reading test scores. And so we see that kind of test-based driven curriculum and kind of the damage that it's having on students' ability to kind of learn in the best way. And so that's definitely going to be something that we address at the conference.
And I wanted to just ask a further question about the issue that you raised before about civil rights groups and how some of them have come out in favor of testing. And it always makes me wonder when I hear those statements, if they realize the extent of what they're ostensibly voting for, that they really are giving up control of what happens in their children's schools to some corporate interest that actually is in Great Britain. It's not even here. So, Is that going to be part of the specific conversation?
Well, I think there's a couple different reasons why civil rights groups might push for testing. If you read the statement they put out, the Leadership Council put out a statement, it's really because they sometimes see testing as a way to hold schools accountable mm-hmm. for the achievement gap, right? We know that there's a gap in between achievement, Black and Latino students and their white and Asian counterparts. And there's this belief sometimes that if we don't measure learning through testing, that teachers will simply just not teach Black and brown children well. And that's a valid concern. We've had sure. that system ever since we integrated public schools where Black children and Latino children are just written off as uneducable. And so in an effort to not let that happen, they feel like annual testing will enforce teachers to teach these students and raise test scores or be, you know, sanctioned. And so mm-hmm. that's the idea, but that's not how it works out. You know, it's a child who gets punished for their lack of knowledge based on test scores. They're the ones who are either denied a diploma in a high-stakes testing school. In middle school and elementary school, they might be denied to a grade promotion, or they might be taken no electives. And right, instead of going to art or music, you have to take an extra reading class or an extra math class. So it's really the students who are being punished through all the testing instead of it helping them. Testing is never going to close the achievement gap. You know, there are limitations to what testing can kind of do. It can identify areas of concern where students need help, but it's never going to close a gap, right? And so I think that's part of the misunderstanding. There's also people who I think in some of these groups who might get funding from organizations that promote more testing. You know, mm-hmm. if you take Bill Gates' money, then you're probably less likely to be critical of testing because they're a part of that. Mm-hmm. You know, they're funding Common Core and different things. And so I think there's that element there that once you take that money, this is the danger. You either don't criticize testing or you don't oppose it because you don't want to jeopardize your funding. So I think, and so we're going to explore both of those issues because you can work with the folks who are just misunderstand what testing can do and they do want ways to make sure all students are being taught well. And so we can address that without testing. But people who are just, you know, brought into this because of the funding effort, then we need to be able to call those people out even if we can't bring them necessarily to our side.
Now, Denisha, I want to go back to the second part of this theme. Because I think up to now, you know, things have been evolving, but although I think you would agree kind of in the wrong direction. So as part of this thing, you want to ignite a revolution. So I want to know what that revolution looks like. Who's participating? Who's involved in that revolution? And what does that revolution actually look like? And what is the end goal of the revolution? If you can kind of, I know it's probably multiple goals, but if you can kind of speak a little bit to that.
Yeah, well, you know, the revolution is going to look different everywhere. I can't speak for parents and teachers in another area because they're all going through their same thing. So I think the revolution is going to look different in different places. I hope who's in the revolution, I hope parents, teachers, and students, and just concerned citizens who don't like the way our public education system is headed and want to see that different changes for it. Well, we talk about revolution, like I'm not an anarchist. I don't want us to just overthrow the government. I'm not one of those people who thinks we need to disband the Department of Education and remove all federal ties to education. That's not what I mean by revolution, but
right.
I think when parents and students and teachers say enough is enough, like we are not okay what's being done to our education system in our name, right? Teachers are experts about, you know, helping young children learn, and parents are experts about what engages and motivates their children and what their children need, and students are even experts in what they need and what, you know, engages them as well. So we want them at the forefront of this, telling us.
And Denisha, that's why I asked that question, because, you know as well as I do that there have been all kinds of slaps in the faces to parents and students and teachers. You know, every city in this country just about has an example of that. And so, you know, that's why I asked, because, to me, some people are fed up. They've been fed up. But how do you get those people involved that continually just put up with it? I mean, there's a lot of complacency, you know, still out there. I mean, I'll give you an example here in the District of Columbia. I'll use my own ward, Ward 8, as an example of that. You know, they have been putting up and putting up and putting up, and for some reason we can't find a catalyst to get them to revolt against what's going on and to stand up for themselves and to do something about it. And so that's really, I know you probably can't give me a silver bullet, but you know, that's really what we need to try to find, and get to the heart of is how do we incite folks to really stand up and do something? Because, you know, you're a professor and they're teachers. These folks, you know, they get it. They've been fighting and pushing and kicking and scratching for a long time. And so we got to broaden that coalition. And so, I mean, you know, politicians listen to their constituents. And so how do we, on a massive scale, create the momentum and generate the enthusiasm within the masses of people in terms of the parents and community members to really and coordinate this effort to really be effective? That's, I guess I'm looking for the answer to that, because I think that's how we're really going to be able to really push back against all these moneyed interests. I mean, billions of dollars are being brought to bear. And so we don't have, we can't match them dollar for dollar. We, our only hope is to match them with public opinion and push back because of what they've been doing. And so, I mean, we probably can't get you the answer to that question today. I'm not even sure I'm articulating the question right, but.
No, yeah. I totally understand what you're saying, but you said something that was key to my response. You said stakeholders listen to their constituents, and I think that's where we have to begin, with the idea of listening to the people in the communities. I've heard of different teacher groups. There's a caucus of teachers in Philadelphia called WE, the Working Educators Teachers. They're running a huge platform right now to vote out their current Pennsylvania Federation of Teachers slate, because they have not been doing what they want. But they started this by first holding listening sessions where they listened to teachers across Philadelphia to find out what they wanted. I know a friend in Seattle who also did something similar with her teacher organization. So one of the things I'm proposing with another organization I work with, Defending the Early Years, is we keep hearing that a lot of parents are coming to early childhood teachers and demanding academics, right? Demanding that the kids be reading, that they do homework, that they do less play. These are parents demanding these things, right? So it puts a teacher in a tough spot, because you know that a five-year-old doesn't need to be reading. They need to be playing and learning how to self-regulate their emotions, but you have parents demanding this. So my thing, instead of just saying the parents are wrong, we need to listen to the parents. So we're trying to organize listening sessions with parents of young children, particularly black and brown parents, to kind of find out what is their thinking around early childhood education. What do they see? And where does this all come from? Is it just this fear that their child doesn't read by five, then they're not going to get a good job or graduate high school and those sorts of things? So we want to first listen, because yes, I'm a researcher, but I'm not a parent. So I can't make assumptions about what parents think. I need to get to parents and ask them what's going on. What do they see what's happening in education? I think once we start listening, then you're never going to get anyone to engage with you unless you have an open dialogue first. So letting parents and asking them not to just listen to me, but to listen to them, so they can really share what's happening. So that's our goal for Defending the Early Years. We're working on locations right now to kind of kick off listening sessions for early childhood parents, I think, and other organizations have done that and been successful, because that's how we build it. You're right, we don't have the money, but we have the votes. And we have each other once we can all come to an understanding. But we're not all on the same plane, right? So we need that first level where we can all start off. So I'm hoping that that's one way to get this going. And I think the town hall for the United Mapped Out event is a way to do that. It's not just us up there talking to parents. We're inviting local Philadelphians to come and talk to us about their system, their school system. What do they need? Where do they see things going? What are their concerns? Because that's really going to help us be of service to them.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. Yeah, that I'm glad that you all added that, because getting the community behind you in these different cities is vitally important, because, you know, and at some point, because your group is national and United Opt Out is national and Save Our Schools is national, at some point, going to have to join in with all the other national organizations and try to construct and a specific action plan that can be rolled out all across this country. Because once you incite folks to do something, then we got to give them precise steps to take in order to be effective. So is that something that your organization has given thought to about, okay, once we get people motivated to act, what are we going to give them specific steps to take?
Yes, I mean, that's something that United Opt-Out is looking at, but more globally, like you said, it is a coalition of organizations that are coming together. So as you know, in 2011, Save Our Schools organized a really big march and rally for public education. And at that event, they said 5 years later that they would come back together. So that's now this summer, 2016. But because of that event in 2011, all of these groups now were born out of that event. Badass Teachers, United Opt-Out, Network for Public Education, many of the grassroots groups that we've had guests on the show, all of these organizations started after that event. Many of us met. I met most of the badass people there. I met a lot of the United Opt-Out people there. Not all of us were there, but many of us. And so we came together. So now we're formed a coalition of groups that are going to kind of put together this event. So it's not just Save Our School, it's Save Our School, United Opt Out, Badass Teachers, a couple union groups as well, local union groups to plan this event. And one of the things we want to do on one of those days is to do that, to strategize around actions that we can all kind of engage in to kind of move us forward. Because we're no longer, you know, just, we all have our different methods of what we do, right? United Opt Out is, you know, has their goal of doing things. Badass Teachers has theirs, Network for Public Education. So how can we use all what we're doing in a way that kind of sends this unified message to kind of help people move forward? And I think that's going to be a really big part of what we do in July in Washington, D.C.
All right. So you said that this conference for Philly is about sold out. So how do folks who are interested in attending the conference, how do they go about doing that?
Yeah, unfortunately, we had some space limitations for the location that we got, so I think we've reached the maximum. We're looking into possibility of some live streaming, and so hopefully that'll allow people to like listen in at least to our major keynotes. Again, the Thursday night event will be open to the public and free, so that's one possibility to still come. And if we are able to like secure another room, then we'll add more tickets. But it's definitely just because of the location that we got that we're kind of limited on how many people could be. But we're hoping we don't do anything that requires the fire marshal to come shut us down.
Well, you certainly don't want that. So are there any media outlets in Philadelphia that are a part of this effort or going to be carrying or broadcasting this effort or taping it?
Yeah, that's our next step, is to find out a way to live stream it. And as soon as we do, we'll let you know. We'll go ahead and post that so you can share it as well. And if you know of any, please let us know. But we're hoping that we can find someone who can at least get the show out to people who can't come all the way to Philly for it.
I know that's a service that we at WEAC Radio provide. I don't know if our folks will be willing to travel to Philadelphia, but I can certainly present them with that prospect and see how they respond to it. I'm sorry?
That'd be great. Our next bus show is actually the Thursday of the town hall, so I'm still trying to figure out how I work this out. Do I do the show and then drive to Philly? But yeah, I was thinking of a way to connect it, but we can definitely be in touch about that. We've had someone do live streaming before, but he lives in California, so it's difficult to get him out to Philly for this event. So,
yeah, I would imagine. But like I said, you know, WEAC Radio, we that's a part of the services we provide to the community, and so we can certainly talk about that offline. Is there anything else that you want to add? Because we are just running out of time. We're, you know, reaching the bottom of the hour, and that's where we're going to stop for this installment of the Education Town Hall. So in about 30 seconds, do you have anything to conclude with?
Just wanted to thank you again for the opportunity. I just, you know, want to let people know there's a lot going on out there. We're aware of what's happening in Detroit and Flint and all around the world where people are fighting for good public education, and just want to remind people to keep fighting the good fight.
All righty. That's going to have to be the last word. Thank you so much, Denisha Jones, professor at Howard University. Folks, we've kind of rearranged the show format, time frame today, but we're glad that you hung in there with us. I want to thank you for doing so. Until next week, next Thursday at 11 a.m., have a great week. For Ron Pinchback, our engineer, Virginia Spatz, our feature reporter, this is your humble servant and host, Thomas Byrd. Peace.